on your wrist, you kind of, it's always the before, not the kind of after, that is the enjoyment. Yeah. So everyone's slightly different.
I must have queued up for hours for the Omega Swatch collaboration.
And you probably sold it 5 minutes later.
10.
Yeah.
I put it on my wrist and I was like, nope, don't like it. And I chased it for a few months too. And I was like, nope, that's not for me.
So for a lot of people, it's the hunt, which is the exciting bit. And if you think about it, a lot of people in life, whether it's watches or something else, it's actually, you know, the hunt and finding something and the build up and, you know, whatever it is. So everyone's different.
Yeah. But
just always, always go see the watch. Sorry. I feel like I need to advise people. Go see the watch. Hold the watch. Put it on your wrist.
Not everyone.
No, but a lot of
You're killing my online business here. What's
go
wrong?
See it. Come back and buy it online.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Startup Garage. I'm thrilled to introduce two extraordinary guests today, each bringing their unique touch of luxury to our show. Our first guest is the man behind the wristwear revolution in the UAE and GCC, the co-founder of Timepiece 360, Khalid. He's turned the art of trading luxury watches into a finely tuned masterpiece. If time is money, this guy is the ultimate timekeeper.
That's a nice intro.
And alongside him, we have a man who knows his luxury watches like he knows the back of his hand, a passionate collector and a Timepiece 360 customer. His wrist has more style than a fashion runway, and he's here to share his love for luxury timepieces and his tales of hunting down that perfect watch. So welcome, Ismail.
Thank you.
Together, we're diving into the world of luxury, the glitz, the glam, and of course, the wrist candy that makes us all tick. Get ready for an hour of insight, laughter, and some time well spent. So without further ado, let's wind up those watches and dive in. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Am I a customer? Is that how many customers?
You're a long-standing customer. You're a VIP customer, I think, by now, no? Like, we don't treat you VIP.
A founding customer? Huh? I just feel a founding customer.
He's been asking me to invest now for about 4 years.
Yeah, founding customer. I mean, I was there at the early stages when you're back of a counter and sending a shop in JBR.
Yeah,
I was there.
2017. I think if you look at my phone, my phone for Ismail has, when I first started, to remember people, I used to put what, if they're buying or selling, so B or S, the name, the date, and the watch they're interested in. Because I'm quite forgetful. So when he calls like the following month or month, I say, hey, how's that watch? And all that kind of stuff. So Ismail's done at February 2017, buying a Rolex Milgauss.
Yes.
Correct?
Yes, yes.
Is that how his name is still?
If you check my phone, that's how it's still saved now.
Still buying, buying.
And I still have your Khalid timepiece.
See?
Awesome. So Khalid, let's start off with your background and how Timepiece 360 came into being. I mean, you have a rather really interesting background. I mean, from equity trading on the Wall Street and Morgan Stanley to now trading watches for quite some time now, and you also have really interesting things that you do apart from Timepiece 360. So tell us about your background and how it all came into being.
Yes, it's not that interesting, but it's trading. So I born and brought up in the UK, but Egyptian of origin and proud. I studied in the UK, and then really the first and the only job I've had was within investment banking. So I joined in the graduate program back in 2001 and spent 12 years in investment banking. It's a US investment bank, predominantly in London. And then they moved me out here to Dubai, did various things in banking and enjoyed it for the most part. Biggest challenge with banking. So I think once you've done around after I'd done 8 years, you start to think and wonder, what else can I do? Because you become a machine, right? You become a machine. It's a 12, 13-hour day after day. But, you know, the one thing I'd say about banking is they pay you well enough to think 100 times before leaving, because it's very hard to match. Yeah. And they work you so hard that you don't even have time to think about leaving. So that idea was always there from early on, you know, could I leave? Could I do my own thing? I think I was telling someone yesterday we were interviewing. I think throughout most people's careers, and I know Ismail has had that thought, everyone has that thought of, you know, can I go on my own?
Yeah.
Right? But it's tough, right? It's tough to leave the comfort of employment, getting paid, the security of payment, getting paid every month. In my case, I was very lucky to get paid pretty good. It goes through a lot of people's minds, but very few people do it.
Yeah.
And actually, it was with me for 2 years and I didn't have the bottle to do it. But then I transferred out here with work. Back then, they were looking post-financial crash in 2009. They wanted to boost the region and grow it again. So I was lucky enough to move out here. Spent 2 years here. And then back then, it didn't really take off like they wanted it to do. So really, they at the time, they cut the whole desk. So for me, it was a calling. So when I had two options back then. I could move back to London and continue on with banking and stay in the career, or I could stay. I think back then we'd had our first child and the second was coming. So with the support of my wife, and she was very supportive, I took a decision where I was, let's say, financially provisioned to take a risk. And the worst thing that could happen, we came to the conclusion, is that we lose our savings and we go back to the UK and I get a job. So you have to have a supportive family in order to be able to do that. Because the realization is that you could go, and for my case, I went 3 years without a salary. Mm-hmm. So you have to be able to stomach not getting paid and being able to survive. And I was lucky enough that I could do that. So we took a decision that I would try it for a period of time. Mm-hmm. If we got to a red line, and I had a red line in mind, once we got to that level, I'd go back into employment. And that's really how I started. Not timepiece, but that's how I started the venture away from banking and into call it entrepreneurship, call it whatever you want, but trying to do my own thing.
I think there's a quote by Talib. He says the three most dangerous addictions in the world are heroin, sugar, and a monthly salary.
it's absolutely true. Yeah. Because to leave that, it's a huge risk, right?
Yeah. And to be able to do that after, I mean, you would expect someone to, I mean, the 2008, 2009 crisis, and you would expect people to become more sort of risk averse after that, right? But then you went ahead and you started on your own. After that, so that takes a lot of
I think the biggest challenge we face in the last 10-15 years is that, you know, since from the moment you graduate, you're conditioned that, you know, you need money and you need a salary to be able to survive, and that's why they call it that, if you live in a city, the rat race. Because it is a never-ending cycle.
But then how did the whole idea of Timepiece 360 come into being? Where did your passion for watches and luxury start? And then was it when you were still in banking and because you were making money, so you'd go out and buy luxury products, or was it later?
Yeah, so look, I was never into watches per se, but because of the nature of where I worked, watches was kind of a common factor and a common theme, especially around bonus time. So watches was quite prevalent. But no, when I left where I was working, the way I thought to minimize my risk, because I was thinking, well, how can I do it and to insure, was I tried doing four or five things at the same time. So I thought if I have, because I think officially in terms of statistics, any startup has over a 90% failure rate, right? Yeah. So the likelihood of something succeeding is very low. So I thought if I start four things, you know, then the percentage kind of goes down. I did that in the end. So I started, what did I start first? The first thing I start, Timepiece came later down the line. I think the first thing I did was actually I invested, the first lesson I learned was the second, well, actually it was the first big lesson, is I learned a lot of lessons in those 3 years. One of them was never to invest with friends, because in my case, it ruined a perfectly good friendship.
Yeah.
That's why you don't want me in.
That is one of the main reasons. So every about two or three things I tried, the ones I tried with friends, ended up, you don't really know someone until money comes in and gets involved. And for whatever reason, one reason or the other, it becomes very, very tough. So one of the things I invested in early on didn't work out. That was in foods business. Mm-hmm. The second business I invested in, I was meant to be a co-founder in, was a company startup business. Mm-hmm. And that went foul quite early on. The third business I went into was actually with my wife, and that kind of worked. And we sold that later, not for big money or anything, but it was never meant to be big, but it's meant to be something we did together. And we sold that later on. Mm-hmm. And I think Timepiece was kind of idea 4 or 5. And really the idea behind Timepiece 360 was, back at the time, there was a company in the UK called Watchfinder.
Okay.
And I've told that to the founders of, or to the CEO of Watchfinder, actually, a few years ago. They were growing within the kind of pre-owned space. Mm-hmm. So their model was, you had the primary market, meaning I could go to a boutique and buy a watch, or I can go to buy a pre-owned watch. And the onus and the kind of the idea back then is, why pay for brand new mm-hmm. when you can pay less for something pre-owned, have the warranty. And the idea behind the watch, especially a luxury watch, is they can last forever, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, cars have a 5-year cycle. After 5 years, you know, a car is worth zero value on any company book. Whereas a watch can last forever. And back then, in very, very few cases, they can actually go up in value. Mm-hmm. So a watch made sense. Secondly, a watch is an art. Horology is considered by many a form of art. Mm-hmm. And really, the technology behind watches hasn't really changed since the inception of watchmaking, right? So the idea, there are advancements, but mm-hmm. this notion of a watch and the mechanics behind what makes a watch hasn't really changed. So all of these facets got me intrigued. And then back then, the market here, the pre-owned market did exist, but it mm-hmm. existed in the form of the gold souk. So if you wanted to buy a pre-owned Rolex, let's say, you would go to the gold souk. And in the gold souk, it was never really... Buying a watch there was like buying a mug in a shop or buying a mobile phone. You didn't have that experience of buying something luxury. So the service wasn't there, the experience wasn't there. You didn't know anything about the history of the watch. There was no service center where you can ensure that the watch was, you know, authentic, taken care of, had all those kind of warranties. Mm-hmm. So what I saw when Watchfinder were doing, and they were growing quite slowly, but doing a great job, and nothing existed here, but there was appetite. Mm-hmm. That's really where the idea of Timepiece kind of came about as an idea. Mm. And then the next challenge was, how do you take an idea and then execute it? And that was the next big challenge.
You put it very, very simply. And I mean, whatever knowledge that I have of the whole watch industry comes from this man. So, so
he teaches me very well.
So my next question to Ismail, if we can, I mean, you've been a watch collector for quite some time now. So, and you've spent quite a lot of money, I know. And watches.
Thankfully. So,
a Timepiece 360.
So what is really the psyche behind buying expensive luxury watches, considering it an art, and really honoring the heritage and the craftsmanship that you Absolutely. That you keep talking about, and the millions of videos that you've shown me about watches. Wow.
So I agree with the question, every bit of it. The expensive part, I don't. Not because some of the watches are not expensive, but value of a watch, in my opinion, is not about the price. Some of the watches, the greatest watches out there, could be very humble. Let me put it this way. The Seikos, the Tissots, because my first watch was ever a Tissot, right? And I appreciate that. And
Your first watch was a Calvin Klein.
My first choice was a Calvin Klein. And thankfully, someone corrected me. Before buying that specific watch, I'll tell you that story in a bit. But that's the beauty of watches, right? At the end of the day, it's your personal connection to each item. When I first met Khaled on that day, right?
Sounds like we're getting married. A fateful day.
17th of February in 2017. The whole idea is I knew exactly what I wanted. And I went to him and I was like, I want a Milgauss. Because it was engraved in my mind that I wanted that watch for almost 5 years. And I knew at that time I couldn't afford it, right? I saw it at the hands of successful businessmen and people that I look up to. Mm-hmm. That particular watch was unique in nature. It still has a Thunderbolt, which is discontinued right now. Mm-hmm. It had 1,000 magnetic resistance to the Gauss, which is now called Milgauss, which now, by the way, I know 1,000 is not impressive. And there are other brands that do 15,000, right? but the story, the look, the feel, the luxury, and also how I looked up to those people in mm-hmm. my life who had these watches. And I remember them perfectly, right? Mm-hmm. And that's why I wanted to buy that watch. And that's why and that watch was my first, I'd say, luxury watch.
So ask him how much did he pay for it? Because then he'll show you the value. How much did you pay for that watch?
18K, I remember that.
18,000. So that watch, he paid 18,000 in 2017, right? Wow. So today this watch, because it's discontinued now, it's probably over 40,000 dirhams.
Absolutely.
Wow.
So
absolutely.
It gives you an idea, but that should never be the intention.
Yeah.
But it gives you an idea, you know, these are things that hold value. So, mm-hmm. you know, over the last few years, okay, the economics of watches has changed, mm-hmm. but the concept has always stayed that these items hold value. So the beauty of watches is that you can buy something, wear it for a few years, sell it, trade it up, trade it down.
If you buy the right one, too.
Yeah, but even if you buy the wrong one and you keep it long enough, they tend to hold value, right?
I disagree.
Really?
Absolutely. Sometimes when you buy wrong...
But his problem is he's never held a watch for more than 2 months before he sells it. So he never feels that.
But I'm trying to really uncover. I mean, one thing is, of course, that you look up to these people and these people own these watches. And then you also talk about how...
But then I got to understand what watches are. What are they made of? Art behind
but
it.
But you have
right?
to remember also, right? Watches, a lot of watches had a purpose. So they're tool watches, yes, right? So the watch which Ismail is referring to wasn't made initially as a luxury item or a watch mm-hmm. for people. It was actually had a specific purpose. And a lot of watches, if you go back in history, they were made for a purpose. And probably the most famous brand for doing that today, because for many different reasons,
Rolex.
Rolex was
meant for scientists who are working in laboratories. So it's anti-magnetic. So they keep good time, basically, right? Mm. Watches, there are movements that have small parts, and if you get a magnet close to them mm-hmm. for a longer time, that might run the watch slow or fast depending on the angle, right? But all of the stuff I didn't know, because I didn't know what was inside the watch. And then I realized there's something called the movement. And what's a movement? It's the magic that makes this watch work. And believe it or not, it took me a while to realize it's not battery operated. It just moves. It's magic. It's a spirit that's moving around. I was like, well, that's very hard to make. Like, you know, in order to have energy, you have to exhaust energy, right? These are the rules. So where do they get the energy from? You get the energy from your body movement. Some of them you wind them up manually, but mostly the automatic ones are from your movement. Mm-hmm. I was like, wow, somebody thought about transforming kinetic energy into powering a watch. That must be very new. They must have done it like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. No, 200 years ago. I was like, are you kidding me? Some of the greatest watch houses have been around since the 1800s. Some of them even claim 1700s in continuation, right? And they're like, so that technology existed? And they're like, absolutely. And I was like, okay, I want to buy this. I want to buy that. I want to buy that. They're not available. Why? Because it takes a craftsman, a master, sometimes up to 6 months to make one timepiece. I was like, wow, are you kidding me? And they're like, yeah. All the parts. And then I start looking and watching videos. Obviously, I can't open my own watch, but it's like some of them have hundreds of parts. And then, and then I got introduced to what a complication is. So part of what a watch could do is tell the time, but there are certain additions, complications, a different time zone, a different purpose, a calendar, a date, and I'm not going to get into the details of it, but think of it as they're just layers on top of a movement, right? So the movement just tells the time. You had a complication, that's a date. You had the day-date, that's another complication, a different time zone, a third complication. And depending on the functionality or the purpose of the tool watch, is it a diving watch? Does it have a helium escape valve? Does it have a sapphire crystal that won't crack under pressure? And then I loved the art of watchmaking. Then I got a little bit deeper into that, who designed the watches, and then realized there are gods of watchmaking, right? And then it's like, okay, the purpose of them. And then last but not least, and this is why I started the very long question, the price tag. Some of the greatest watches are not expensive. Some of them are really, the top amazing ones are super expensive because everyone knows their value. But to the watch collector out there, you don't have to start with a 18,000, now 40,000 Milgas. You can start with a very reputable, amazing Japanese watch. I think Orients, maybe, even Citizens.
That's hundreds of brands.
Yeah. For like a Seikos, for like a few hundred.
Yeah.
Right? And once, and it's your own journey. You will get to realize what is it that you like, and you follow that pursuit. I saw, when we were prepping for this, I just saw an old video of yours. No, I did. But I saw an old video of yours where you're interviewing a gentleman on your channel, and he had an infatuation with military watches and only military watches. And I'm just like, I didn't know that was a thing. I didn't know that someone was just only those, right? And then you realize.
Yeah.
So I'm dubbed as the complication guy. I like to have different complications, right? I look for different. I don't like owning two watches, even if they're two different brands that they do the same thing, right?
Wow.
And everyone got their own story, and we talk to people who love watches. They'll tell you their own story, and this is why I don't want to put value on it. I've lost on watches. I've made money on watches. Right, I bought a watch 20 minutes ago from this guy in the parking lot.
It's in the car. If you want to see it.
But the story continues, and I see that value transferable. I agree with you. We shouldn't look at it from an investment standpoint, but the reality of the situation is, Khaled, watches have become currency, whether we like it or not.
Yeah. So over the last few years. Certain events and things have happened which have changed the dynamics of watches, which meant that a lot of people, especially during COVID, a lot of people started treating them in the same way you would treat an equity stock, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to buy this because I can make money.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd buy it, they'd put it in a safe, and they'd expect to sell it a year later for more money. And that might happen, but again, you're losing, you know, everything that Ismail just spoke about of what watchmaking is. And one thing really important to remember, I think a lot of people don't really realize, is that we live in a very tech-driven age where everything is automated and everything is systematic. And whereas with watchmaking, you know, the watch he has on and the watch he has, humans made, you know, I mean, there's watchmakers who sat there and put things, there's parts which are automated, but there's that human connection, there's that human touch of a watchmaker sitting there with the movement, with the parts, putting it together and making a watch. And there's very few things today where you see that which are not automated. So a watchmaker, and it's becoming a rare breed, so you know, there is a challenge, even we struggle with it. There is a challenge today, there's not many watchmakers coming through. Who graduates from school? You know, who from your kids or my kids or says, I want to become a watchmaker? Very few, right? Very few people are still skilled with their hands, not just in watchmaking, but in, when's the last time you saw a baker, right? A bakery shop. And it's the same kind of concept. There's very few people want to work with their hands.
Yeah.
Watchmaking, you do, and it's a dying breed. So you're on his wrist or my wrist or on your wrist, you've got something which someone actually put together by hand. And I think that's pretty unique.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's this general appreciation for the art that watchmaking is, and of course there's the luxury brands, and then like you said, there are brands that are not that expensive, but they are a work of art. And then if you dive a little deeper into the real motivation of buying luxury brands, there's, I mean, of course, like you said, it's way more complicated than I expected it to be, because once you really start understanding what kind of watch collectors are there, like you said, you like complicated watches, and then there are guys who like military watches. So in your experience, Khaled, I'm sure you've seen like just so many customers at Timepiece 360. What is the general sort of notion? What are some interesting stories around customers, some weird stories, their obsession? I mean, to what degree does it go to?
Look, luxury is a subjective term. What makes a watch luxury, or what? I don't know. You know where the boundary starts for what? Because is a Seiko a luxury watch or not? I don't know. Is a Casio a luxury watch? I don't know what the boundary is.
Entry level luxury, mid luxury.
Entry. We try and define it, but I don't know if it has a definition. But what do we see? We see all sorts of people coming in to buy watches. You know, we have on one side, you know, people like Ismail, who are genuine collectors, who have a passion for horology and an interest. And I call it an addiction. Maybe he calls it something else, but they have that kind of urge. So he's bad, but I've seen much worse in terms of addiction to watches. And then you have on the opposite end of the scale, you have people who buy them because it is a status symbol.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, if I have a Rolex on my wrist, it means something. In a similar kind of way, where diamonds were marketed in such a way that, you know, the you know, when I propose to someone, I buy them a diamond ring because, you know, that's what it means. And that's a whole marketing thing, right?
Yeah.
So a symbol of success, you know, is a luxury watch, and it can be a Rolex. You know, for a long, long time, Rolex have a model called the Day-Date. And that was always billed as the president's watch, right? So, and it has a, you know, it's called the president's day date. So for a lot of people reaching a certain level in life, you know, that has to be celebrated with buying a Rolex day date, because that symbolizes a certain level of success. So you have some people on that end, you have some other people who with, you know, their shoes or their clothing or that kind of, I want to have it so people see that I have this watch on my wrist. There are people who have that. And then you have people on the other end of the scale who have a passion for horology and watches. And one day they may be wearing a $100,000 watch, and the next day they may be wearing a $500 watch. And to them, it's not about the, you know, the amount, which Ismail was talking about, but it's about the the wristwatch itself. And we've seen all, you know, we get all kinds, and you have to, the challenge is you have to appeal to all that, you know, to the different audiences, right?
Yeah.
So the person is who's into horology, and we love people like, you know, he's maybe sometimes a pain up the backside when it comes to pricing. So the problem with collectors are the worst type of customers. Some collectors, not all, because they probably know more about watches than you do, right? And they know more about the pricing, and they know more about kind of stuff. So it's tough. With first-time buyers, it's a bit easy because you're helping them, you're guiding them, and you're showing them the kind of way and the path. But I've seen people who have, you know, I think early on, we had a gentleman from Zanzibar. Zanzibar? Mm-hmm. Yeah, Zanzibar. Mm. Early on, when we first met him, his first watch from us was a Breitling. It was around 6,000 dirhams. It got him hooked onto watches, and within a year, he was onto his third Patek Philippe.
Oh, wow.
So he
third Patek.
And he lived abroad. So he scaled up really, really, really quickly. Obviously, he could afford to. He was pretty successful in what he was doing. But he's a person who fell in love and was able to... But he went up. He didn't jump. He experienced every single stage. So he started off on a very entry level, went to Breitling, then something like an Omega, and he went through them, IWC, and then a Rolex, and then a Vacheron, and then an AP, and then so I don't know if it was a case that he got bored, but he, and there is always this thing about, for a lot of collectors, the fun is in the chase. So for a lot of people, sometimes it's finding that watch. That's where the fun is, and kind of once you put it on your wrist, you kind of, it's always the before, not the kind of after, that is the enjoyment. Yeah. So everyone's slightly different.
I must have queued up for hours for the Omega Swatch collaboration.
And you probably sold it 5 minutes later.
10.
Yeah.
I put it on my wrist, and I was like, nope, don't like it. And I chased it for a few months too, and I was like, nope, that's not for me.
So for a lot of people, it's the hunt, which is the exciting bit. And if you think about it, a lot of people in life, whether it's watches or something else, it's actually, you know, the hunt and finding something and the build up and, you know, whatever it is. So everyone's different.
Yeah. But
just always go see the watch. Sorry. I feel like I need to advise people, go see the watch, hold the watch, put it on your wrist.
Not everyone.
No, but right. a lot of
my online business. You're killing my online business here. What's
go
wrong?
See it, come back and buy it online. A lot of infatuation that you mm-hmm. could have with watches mm-hmm. cannot be only 2D. It has to be 3D. Yeah, I need to put it. Talking about watch that I regret buying. You remember the Seed Dweller Rolex that I bought?
Yeah, the fat watch. He was showing me the beefy, fatty watch.
I saw it. Khaled's like, why are you interested in this? I was like, I liked it. And it looked a little bit like a sub, but a little different. And I hated that everyone was wearing a sub and I wanted to be a little bit different. And he's like, hey, buddy, it's a little bit beefy, right? Mm-hmm. I was like, no. I get it. And I should have researched it. I should have known that it's made from slightly different metal than the other Rolexes, thicker, denser, the size and everything. And the minute I put it on, and even though he said, it might not be the best watch for you, I know you, it's like, no, dude, it's a Roro. It's a Rolex.
I'm ethical.
Yeah, put it on. He's like, oh my God, this is so heavy. Oh my God, I can't put it under a dressing cuff sleeve, right?
And but we made him lose money to learn his lesson when I bought it back.
Oh my God, I go back to him the next day. He's like, I'm sorry, I should have listened to you. So a lot of infatuation. I mean, watches.
But sometimes, isn't life about experiences?
No, but
then you have to experience something depends, bad right? to know.
Yeah. So from his side, you know, he gained a few bucks. From my side, I lost a few bucks. And my advice to collectors is, you know, just yes, there is a connection. Yes, you'd be infatuated with a lot of things online, the specs, the reviews, and everything. But go connect to it. Look mm-hmm. at it.
Yeah.
You know, and just feel how you feel. You'd be surprised, right?
You're gonna marry the watch?
No. listen, man. I spend with my watches a little bit more time than I spend with my wife, right?
We have had a guy. I remember that as soon as you said that early on, he used to always ask us. He was a really good guy, but he's like, "Can I take it home?" For like, he always say like, "I like this watch."
Don't take it home.
But he always just asks, "Can I take it home?" And then go to sleep and then come back and then I'll take it on.
Oh my God.
And yeah, he wanted. He maybe took it a bit too far. His connection, quote unquote connection.
But I mean, that's the. Every watch got a story. Every watch got the whole connection with it, infatuation. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You know, with a lot of what's going on online, virals, TikToks, videos, man, the Tissot PRX. I wanted to buy that watch because all of the reviews were amazing. It's the best watch, value for money. It combines everything in the world of luxury. 80 hours power reserve, integrated bracelet, beautiful Paris blue dot. Everything is perfect. Went to the store, put it on. Not the watch for me. Don't get me wrong. It's amazing. It might be right. It might be too big for some people. It might be too small for some people. And that's why they have released the 35mm, I think, recently. Yeah. But immediately, I knew it wasn't the watch for me.
Yeah.
After probably a month and a half of anticipation, I'm looking for it. So it's different, right? I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
Buy online still.
20% code.
And I think this is one of those trends in the industry now. And one of them is, of course, like you said, the president's watch and people who reach a certain level in their careers or their professional lives, they want to buy that watch. But now there's a general shift in terms of luxury items that people have started to buy. It's become very aspirational and people have... I mean, it's not just the ultra-rich that buy luxury now.
No.
It's started to change. And another shift is... in where they buy it, the channel in which they buy it. So online, of course, contrary to what Ismail feels, I think online is picking up and online is another trend. And there's a general sense of shift in terms of certain trends on how people buy the watches and on what's happening in terms of the trade that happens between the watches. And like you said, now it's becoming a currency. So how do you see that playing out now in the future from a customer's perspective? And we'll come to the luxury brands and Ismail's taught me a lot about that. So we'll come to that part. But purely from a customer perspective, what's really changing? I know there are a lot of exchanges now. Like this is something I got to know today, that there's literally a Rolex watch price index. And my mind was blown. I was like, I mean, people have gotten so deep into this that they have a have an index for this?
It's an asset. It's becoming more and more of an asset. Look, the industry since we started has shifted. Recently, let's say most recently has been, let's say, a bit tainted. But when we started, the kind of the model was, you know, why buy new when you can buy pre-owned?
Yeah.
Right. So why pay? Let's take his example again. You know, the retail price of his watch when he bought it was probably around 27. Why pay 27 or 26 or whatever it was when you can pay 18,000 and it's still the same watch, still lasts forever. So that was always the model, and that model stayed all the way up until, but not for all brands. But no, actually, that applied for all brands. Up until COVID. Just before COVID. Once COVID hit, here's another lesson for you. Always do opposite what I tell you to do. So when COVID hit, we took a view that, you know, the world would end and no one would be interested in luxury watches, right? So, you know, who would be, right? You're hitting the biggest pandemic the world has ever seen. Everyone is stuck at home. People are scared that they're going to lose their jobs. There's, you know, people talk about the world ending, you know, and you know, things being a disaster. So who would be interested in a watch? So our view at the time was prices were going to go down because no one's going to be interested in luxury at a time like this. So sell what we can get, you know, sell what we have. So we went aggressive to sell our stock because we don't want to be sitting with stock, which we thought inevitably in a pandemic, you know, it's going to go down in value. And the opposite happened. Right? complete opposite happened. You know, the lesson is in times of crisis, people go back to defensive items, things people can touch and feel and see. Yeah. So in the same way, when you hit a recession, people buy gold, right? So gold, they call it a defensive stock. And that's what happened with watches. When disaster struck, people wanted to grab hold onto things which were physical assets, right? So they can put it under their pillows or store it in their safes, or but it, you know, a value. And watches happened to be one of those things. So not only did it hold, it actually went up in value from starting during COVID. And that's from that point onwards, kind of there's this craze that happened with watches. So watches, which you could go and pick up at a store, throughout history, all of a sudden became not available anymore. So if you walked in, and this wasn't applicable to all brands. So people, you have to remember there are, as of yesterday, because I checked, there are 30,000 different models of watches, luxury watches, right? So there's a huge range, right? So when I talk brands, when we talk these price movements now, we're talking about 3 or 4 or 5 different brands. Yeah. There's hundreds of other brands where this didn't apply. But everyone talks about these 3 or 4 brands. So they're reflective of the economy of watches, and they contribute probably still a biggest share of when it comes to sales. So all of a sudden, over a period of a few months, what you saw was watches which were available in store were no longer available. So this concept of a waiting list started appearing. So when we started, only one watch was ever on a waiting list, and that was the Rolex Daytona. That was it. And the Rolex Daytona was on a waiting list. So if I went to Rolex and I said I wanted this particular watch, they'd say it's on a waiting list, join the waiting list. All right. But if I'd have gone to Timepiece 360, I could still buy it pre-owned at a discount to retail. And you have to remember that it was...
Oh, wow. Discount to retail.
Even though it was wait list, we were still selling it at a discount to retail.
Oh, wow.
so that was the first time where people were going to a store, a watch wasn't available. When stuff like this happens, opportunists jump in. So things are not available, so people then start resorting to finding them elsewhere. So when they start to resorting to find them elsewhere, they're willing to pay slightly extra to get it now. So it's a case of, do I wait or do I pay extra and get it now? So some people started saying, do you know what, I'm going to pay extra and get it now. Whilst that's happening, what people sniff opportunities. So when people sniff opportunities, what do they go and do? They go and put themselves on the waiting list. So Ismail, and he didn't do this, but I'm just saying, Ismail, for example, would put himself on a waiting list for a watch, get the watch, says I can sell it at a premium. So, you know, he sells it at a premium, he makes a bit of money, right? So, wow, I made money from really doing nothing. So he does it once, and you hear from Ismail, and he says, guess what? I made money from buying and selling a watch. And you said, well, how can I do that? You say, well, just go add your name to the waiting list. So you go and add your name to the waiting list. Mm. And then he adds his name to a list. I add my name to a waiting list. And all of a sudden, you had watches which really were never popular, all of a sudden are on a waiting list and trading at a premium to retail, which meant frustrated genuine collectors. Because as a genuine collector, if I wanted a watch, all of a sudden, I go to a Rolex boutique and he says, you know, get on a waiting list. Or, you know... and then after waiting list came a wish list. Wow. So at the peak of the climax, you couldn't even get onto a waiting list, which was around 5 to 7 years. You had to get onto a wish list to get onto the waiting list, right? So to do that,
to move up and down depends on your purchase history, and they try to push some other product. Yeah. They're not popular models that you have to buy quite a few of them in order to cement your place on that waiting list.
Wow. Now this actually brings me to that exact segment of how luxury brands market, right? There's this whole sort of cloud around luxury brands, and you have to be on waiting lists, you need to have a relationship with the brand, you need to have purchases and all of that, and they create this scarcity which makes you want the brand even more. So what are your thoughts around that? I mean, why is there so much cloud around these waiting lists and this artificial scarcity that these brands are creating, when genuine luxury collectors, genuine luxury buyers really want it, why can't they just have it then and there?
You're closer to marketing than I am. You can go first.
I understand this is the reality of the situation. I condone it. I don't like it. I don't like where it's heading. I don't like the snobbish attitude of certain brands, authorized retailers, about how they treat and approach their customers. And I find it sometimes is just takes me away from the brand itself. Like, I don't want to be associated with you anymore. Mm. This is how you treat your enthusiasts. And some of it, it just doesn't make sense. So yes, of course, we all know that the big brands, the big stores, everything, you go there and they may or may not been told to be a little bit snobbish in dealing with us, just to give you a sense of supremacy when you're dealing with them. Or you're buying this wallet from this place, and they'd have this amazing accent. Of course, sir. Right?
The English accent?
It's not the English accent. But they have transcended behind the 3 seconds of the snobbishness. So why do you want to go to our store? Some of the stores right now in the country, it's just amazing. There's a queue outside as if you're going to a nightclub. And I'm queuing outside Mall of the Emirates on it. And someone comes up to me, why is it that you want to come to my store? He's like, I want to come to your store because whatever the reason, I want to come to your store. You're interviewing me to come into your store, right? And they're like, no, sorry, we only have a capacity of 4 or 5 people at a time. I was like, absolutely. Can I get, and I needed, without mentioning the name, the brand, or I needed a genuine OEM strap for one of my watches. And I was like, because mine was worn off. And to me, this is a very simple transaction. It's a leather strap, it's not even a link. It's universal among other watches, right? And they're like, absolutely, we'll put you on the list. You should get it in 12 weeks. And I was like, excuse me, 12 weeks? And I was like, and at this point, I was having this conversation outside in the hallway. I'm not even inside the boutique. I'm not even out. I'm talking to someone.
You'd never get that timepiece.
Yeah, absolutely. who, for the lack of a better word, is a bouncer in a fancy suit, right? Who's telling me, why don't you come drop us an email, tell us what is it that you want, we'll get it in 12 weeks, you have to pay today. And I was like, what am I paying for? And you'd be lucky if you get it in 12 weeks sometimes, right? And I don't appreciate this at all. And that deters me off brands. And I've made a point that, you know what, this is it. This is the end of the situation. That's why my relationship with Timepiece and amazing partners around Timepiece as well, right, in his network, and they're completely different, because at the end of the day, you'd have a conversation with Khalid 20 minutes about the watch before you end up paying the watch, and then he'd tell you a little bit of the history, and I appreciate that, and then we'd have a little bit of coffee, and then we'd talk, and then he doesn't care about my purchase history. He doesn't care about, like, you know, did I buy something from my wife 2003, and some of those authorized dealers, they're interconnected with different brands, but you have a waiting list on this watch. I said, guys, come on, just let it go. I'm here for the love of the watch. Give it to me. I want it, right?
Yeah, but you see, look, I think every brand's dream is to have a situation where demand outstrips supply, right? Mm. So, you know, and every, I'm sure every brand's, you know, strategies, how can they, everyone wants to sell more than what they actually have. So certain brands, not even in watches, but in bags really? And stuff, mm-hmm. do it amazingly well. In watches, I'm sure it's the same, but you know, everyone wants to really? Sell
it. Khalid, Rolex makes what, a million watches a year? Do you think there's more demand than a supply? Okay, let's not talk about Rolex, that might be very popular. We'll talk about the controversial IWC.
Not because there's genuine engineer. Interest, but because there was a big hype. I told you, when we first started, that didn't exist.
Yeah.
Right? So you could walk into any store and get any watch you wanted. Mm-hmm. But hype, this concept of watches being an investment and makes you money, social media played a big part during the lockdown. Wars have an impact because it's a store of value. So all of these have an impact on people wanting the item, which didn't exist
but
before.
But that translated into poor customer service to my end. The consumer who goes to these places, who wants to acquire, amend, even fix some of these luxury items. Come on, man.
Yeah, so for the brand, it's getting the balance right, right? So it's getting, as a brand, if I was thinking about a brand, how do you balance it so that people really want my things, right? But at the same time, you know, I give you good customer service. So I'll give you another example. There are certain other brands out there where if you go to them and you want a certain item, the minute you say, I like it, they'll give you a discount, right? Mm. They'll give you a discount, right? And depending on how much you push, you can get discounts, right? And you're buying it brand new. But for me, that devalues your item, right? If you're willing to give a discount on it, how, you know, you're a brand with history.
Yeah.
Gaza. If I'm willing to give you a 10, 15, 20% discount there on in, on standing there, I'm devaluing the future value of your brand, of the name and the brand. Yeah. So for me, that's very anti, you know, this concept of demand outstripping supply. If I'm willing already, before you say anything, to give you guys up. But if I stand my ground with a price, you know, at some point, if you know, in this case, there's a lot of hype, but ideally as a brand, that's ultimately where you want to be, right?
But that scarcity, does that make you want, I mean, of course, there are certain people that are sort of
human,
motivated by it.
It's human nature. We always, people want what they can't have. Yeah. It's human. It's human. You want to go to the restaurant that is busy. You want to go to the restaurant that people are talking about on social media. You want them, that's human nature, right?
And you want to go there and complain about it.
Yeah, and you'll complain about it, but it's an innate thing I think humans have. Basically, part of it is how contentment, and contentment is a long topic, but we all have this feature where, you know, if I buy this, sure, well, afterwards, I want that, and then I want that. And it starts with, you know, if you think about 20 years ago, your first ever apartment that you rented. To you, it's probably the biggest place ever. And it's probably a studio flat, but it was your happiest times. But you got there and then you wanted the one bedroom and the two bedroom and the three bedroom.
Yeah.
And I think human nature works in kind of the same way. People want, so when you hear about something which is hard to get or something which is exclusive or something which somebody like Ismail wore, it immediately sort of, you know, I want that thing.
Yeah,
and if you're a brand, if you're able to achieve that, then you do. And so why do brands have brand ambassadors, right? Because then, you know, because David Beckham was this.
Make it aspirational. And you just saw this morning, he was showing me the Patek Philippe ad where they said you never really own a Patek Philippe. You just carry
nearly
it
handed
forward.
Down from one generation to the other.
That's
you see, Patek is probably Patek has the same issue with demand and supply. But Patek has always been on a league of its own because Ismail mentioned, you know, a brand like Rolex produces, it's a mass manufactured brand.
Mm-hmm.
It produces over a million watches a year. When you look at a brand like Patek Philippe, their identity is always based on complications and the history of watchmaking. And if you look at the numbers of watches they make a year, they make probably 5% of what Rolex makes in terms of volume, right? So for them, it always has been, it always will be. It's a very different game.
And these timepieces will last generations, no kidding, right?
There's this also the whole debate around quartz and mechanical, and then there was this quartz crisis in the 1970s, and how the Grand Seiko came into being and then just lifted the whole mechanical watch industry out of the loom.
So what is
spring drive? Oh, okay.
Yeah. So what's your view around?
I wasn't born then, so I have no view.
But since you mentioned this, I mean, that's I think one inflection point, right?
At the end of the day, whatever hundreds of years we're talking in the beautiful the beginning of this beautiful podcast, we said all about the history, the heritage, and everything, the complications, the watchmaker, the master, the manufacturing process, and everything. And then all of a sudden, during the 70s, right, the Japanese folks came up with a small battery, very limited complication, cheaply, but beautifully done, put it in a watch, and now the watch that cost even $1,000 back then now costs a few tens of dollars, right? So $70, $80. And all of a sudden, they can come up with hundreds of them in a day because there's no complications, there's no someone putting them together. And believe it or not, more reliable in timekeeping, right? So the entire world is like, okay, our problem is solved. We have cheaper, more reliable timekeeping mechanism. And this was known as the quartz crisis, with a lot of houses, watch manufacturing houses, they even stopped for a while or even closed down, reopened. But that's another debate on who was the long lasting.
But don't forget, during that period, a lot of these watches were not luxury watches like they are today. Yeah. So, you know, they're in direct competition with the quartz watch. Whereas today, for example, you have the smartwatch, right? So, you know, when the smartwatch came out, a lot of people asked the same question.
I actually think the smartwatch is what saved mechanical watchmaking. Yeah, absolutely. It's what deterred people again from another watch crisis when people realized, oh, absolutely amazing functionality and everything, but where's the soul? Where is the spirit in this?
It's like having a bike and a car. In my eyes, right?
In your eyes, but
they take it from A to B, but they're two very different things.
Yeah, but in other people's mind, it is a transportation tool, right? And they just need a tool. So there'll always be
someone who has bike and doesn't want a car, and they'll always ride a bike. And they exist, and there's lots of them. But someone who has a car, right, may have a bike too. Right?
I bought a digital watch, lasted probably a week.
Yeah, but I know a lot of people who have digital, and they like it.
And then I said, absolutely. Why? Because there's no art, there's no history, there's no heritage, there's no timekeeping, there's nothing. I can't give my son an Apple Watch that is 100 years old, right? I have in my collection an Omega that was made in 1921, almost 100 years in pristine condition.
102 years
in pristine condition. And I showed it at one of your events, and people actually liked it and commended it, and perfect working condition, right? Tell me an Apple Watch would do that. And I think it's just when people realize, oh, okay, this is what's happening for the masses, and this is what they like, the techie stuff. Let's go back to the basics. And that's why you still have manual cars around, right? Everyone's driving automatic. It's wonderful. It's more convenient. But you'd find a true driver who say, no, I want my manual stick shift, right? And it's the same thing. Plus, believe it or not, the technology has been the same, minus the Grand Seiko, which I think we're going to talk about it, because that is the most recent invention in watch mechanism. It's the newest thing, the spring drive, where they put an element of both, right? But at the end of the day, the technology has been there. And believe it or not, and you mentioned that, it's a dying art. If we don't have another generation, every generation, the 90s, we had 10,000 watchmakers, 2,000s, 8,000, right? Yeah,
they don't want to become YouTubers.
Yeah, absolutely. We're running out of watchmakers. And believe it or not, we're going to reach a point where we're not going to have these mechanical watches around, or they'd be assembled by computers, and then they would have lost the value. At the end of the day, the brush strokes, well, I'm saying brush strokes, but I'm saying the strokes at the back of my movement is very unique, even though that we have two watches, it's different to his because it's a person who sat down and done that, right? It will look the same, the jewel will be in the exact same places, but this sign can be slightly different, and that's what makes it unique.
Yeah.
I think the point which Smail mentioned about, a smartwatch, after a year or two, will get thrown away, right? And I think that's, again, that's reminiscent of society we live in today, right? Everything is disposable, right? So you buy a phone, you trade it after a year. You buy clothes, you throw them away after a year. Shoes, cars, everything. Whereas really a watch is something that can stay with you and stay relevant your entire life. And that's why this Patek advert you said is such a prevalent kind of genius, probably marketing thing, because it is. And we get actually a lot of customers who buy a watch and say, I'm buying this now when their child is born, and I'm going to give it to my child when they turn 18. So they wear it and they'll enjoy it for 18 years. But it's their connection to their child, something they bought when the child was born. Mm. They'll keep it for 18 years. And the bonus is it'll probably be worth a lot more. And it's a connection to...
I should use this excuse with my wife.
I'm
not buying it for me.
Yeah, exactly.
It's for my boys when they turn 18. Good one.
Amazing. So I think the last section of this podcast, because I think we are sort of towards the end of this, is just quick questions that I want to throw at you guys and just understand. So the first one is, what are the quirks associated? I know his, but for the audience, what are the quirks associated with owning and buying a luxury watch for you guys?
A quirk?
Like a quirk or kink that you have that you'll only buy it if it's in...
What's your watch for, fetish?
Yeah, let me put it that way.
What's my watch fetish?
Yeah.
I don't think I have a... look, do you know... don't get high on your own supply. So I apply that with watches. So I'm quite objective nowadays when it comes to... When we first started, half the watches that would come in, I'd end up buying because, I'd like this and this is such a good deal and that kind of stuff. And then I stopped. I spent 4 or 5 years with no watch on my wrist. I didn't buy or own a watch. Mm-hmm. Got to a level where I was kind of objective and indifferent in that kind of stuff. I still like watches. But no, I don't. What's your fetish? Watch fetish.
My watch fetish is...
Complications, you said.
Well, yes, but it's not about the actual watch, believe it or not. It's about the history of the watch. And I don't mean the brand history, where was it made and everything.
That's boring. You must have...
No. Who owned that watch? Why did he own it?
I mean, the previous owner?
What condition is the box? Are the manuals there?
Yeah, he's that tough type of... Do you know we get some customers asking us, who owned the watch before?
Yeah, for me, it's all about, at the end of the day, you're putting something on your wrist that somebody have put it on the wrist, and I just want to know their history.
So actually, we get some customers who, yes, they do ask us because they feel that the karma of that person passes through. Uh-huh. So they will ask us certain questions. Was he tell me about him. Right? And I don't know him. I just bought the watch off him. And
you can tell a lot about a person about how they take care of their watch or their car or their any loved belonging items, right? And that's why for me, my fetish is not just literally about the watch. But I want to see what that box condition is like. Where did you store that box? Did you store it in a nice place with the original manuals, with the receipt and everything? Did you just throw it away? Because chances are, if you threw away the boxes, you aren't very, very careful with where you place your watch. You aren't particular about when is it that you should be servicing it and everything. And that's why sometimes there are great deals out there in the market from independent sellers, and I still don't get it because I go to him, because at least even if he doesn't know the history of the watch, he's got the right people in his lab that would look at it and they would kind of decipher its history. I was like, hey dude, has that been serviced? Is it okay? Is everything okay from the inside? Are the scratches bad? Can you buff them up or is it a complete rebuild, right? And believe it or not, like, it matters, right? Yeah. I know I'm getting it at a discount. Most probably sometimes not if you're getting some brands. I mean, I bought the Daytona at a fair market price, but still, I think it's a 2001, maybe 10 times what it was worth in 2001. But I'm also picky about the full set, the complete set.
That's the biggest challenge the industry is facing. So two things. The industry is not a regulated industry. Mm-hmm. So, and that's a big challenge for the industry. And you mentioned it before, watches are becoming like an asset. Mm. So if I compare it to other asset classes, so you have things like equities, like we mentioned at the beginning, you have things like fixed income. So I think in the future, watches will become an asset where they have a buy price and a sell price, right? Mm. So it'll become worldwide known, the price to buy this is this and the buy price is this, just because more and more people are buying it. But the biggest challenge for the industry, because it's not a regulated industry and it's not a centralized industry, right? You've got brands which don't talk to each other from one country to another. So if he was to buy a watch from here and he goes to Spain and ask them about, go to the boutique, ask them to check the watch, they'll say, well, it's not on our system. So they're not not centralized, is, and the dilemma is fakes, counterfeits is the right, is that the right official word?
Yeah.
And that's a huge, huge challenge with the industry today, because the counterfeits have got to such a there's such a level where they are very, very difficult. First of all, very, very difficult to tell apart. And they do what's called like Frankenstein, or, you know, where they'll take parts, you know, they'll take out a part from, you know, they'll take out this and they'll put a fake part.
Oh.
Or they'll take out this bit only and they'll put a fake part. So there's no way, really difficult to tell if the watch is real or fake. And that's a huge, huge challenge.
You had some watches that were Frankensteins, right? They were like 20% genuine, or 40, or 50, or 60.
Yeah, we've had lots. We've seen lots of fake. More so recently, we've seen lots of fake watches come in.
Mm-hmm.
People authenticating or people selling, because they've become very difficult to tell.
Yeah.
We once had but I think he knew it's fake. We once had a kid. He was quite young, early 20s. Coming to sell his watch. He wanted it to fund, I think, a startup or something he was doing. Mm-hmm. He wanted to fund. So he said, look, this, my father got me this watch as a graduation present, and, you know, it means a lot to me, but I really want to sell it because this is my future. Mm-hmm. So how did I knew he was genuine, but so when we inspected, it was fake.
Oh,
so we told him, and you knew he was genuine because of his reaction. Some people, you know, with their reaction, they're chancing it. But this guy was in tears that his father would, you know, buy him a fake thing and make a big deal out of it. So I think we ruined their relationship.
Oh, wow. Oh my God. That's
so we've had that between father and son, husband and wife.
I could assume.
Yeah. So I think we've been, I think we've helped in divorce, right? You know, we've been the cause of some divorces. We've seen some funny stories.
And what are some of the more crazier customer stories and like obscene requests from customers or people
obscene,
just asking for?
We don't really get obscene. Look, some of the scary things we've seen, the scariest thing we've seen is, the husband and wife stories are always the best. So we had a customer, a good customer of ours, we'd known her for a few years, and every so often she'd come and sell a watch, which we would buy, and there were always watches which she could wear, and about 4 years later she came in with her husband, and he asked us for a transaction list of all the watches that she'd sold.
Oh my God.
And it turned out that she was selling his watches behind his back.
Oh wow.
Over 4 years. So yeah, I think that relationship ended. And these are big watches.
Oh wow.
We've had addicts, I'd call them watch addicts, got to such a level where he was hiding his watches that he bought. I think I told this before.
Yeah.
So his wife told him, you know, no more watches.
Hmm.
No more watches. On the case. Yeah. He was just really one of those impulse buyers. So what he would do is he would buy the watch, keep the box with us, and then hide the watch in his shoes.
Oh,
so from his
God.
Wife's perspective, she still saw the 8 or 10 or 12 or whatever watches he did, but he would start hiding them in his shoes. So you get
That's
all
crazy.
Kinds of people.
That's crazy. So the last one there are a lot of, like you said, there are a lot of brands and a lot of watchmakers, and then there's the godfather of watchmaking, and then there's Swiss and Japanese. So what's the one watch that you guys, which is your personal favorite, the one luxury watch that you would, I mean, if you could only wear one.
I can't answer that question again because I feel the objective. But I'd add Japanese, Swiss, but there's many other. Britain, there's brands, Christopher Ward, Vermont, German. So actually, I know everyone always says Swiss.
Japanese,
Swiss is always kind of the watchmaking.
Hmm. Mm. But is that true? Is there something?
Yeah, it still is.
And it's highly regulated by the government, you know, the quality checks and controls.
So, and you'd find if you look at history of some brands started outside and then went to Switzerland to legitimize itself as as a watchmaker. In the same way, if I want to be a startup and I want to be legitimate, I'll go to Silicon Valley, for example, a few years ago. Yeah. It's the same kind of thing.
Yeah, Hamilton, American, moved to Switzerland.
But yeah, but there's many, many brands in many different countries, especially nowadays with the growth of micro brands. You see them popping up all over the place. Mm. But yeah, what's your one watch holy grail?
Yeah, no, like if you could wear only one watch for the rest of your life, which one would it be?
You have to be a one watch man.
One watch man? I think Nautilus.
No, you just stole mine. Yeah, I can't
say no, that. It's not just that. It's again, who created that? He mentioned
the Godfather. Have you won it?
Yes. Who mentioned... So what he meant by the Godfather, I assume you mean the Godfather Gerald Genta, right? Gerald Genta. If I have to pick up one watch, it could be a Gerald Genta watch. Might not be the Patek, the Nautilus. Could be anything. I think, what was it?
The Mickey Mouse one.
The Mickey Mouse one. But a Genta.
He had a brand.
Yeah, he had a Genta later on.
This is the thing people don't really, you know, everyone follows the Nautilus, the AP Royal Oak, and all that kind of stuff. He had a brand of his that flopped.
The Genta, yeah.
Huh? It Genta. Flopped. When we first started, I remember, so my partner back then, it was a watch, you know, he's been doing it for many years. He bought probably about 100 Genta watches back at the time. Couldn't sell any of them. So it's funny how some things do really well.
His own brand, like when he did his own startup. Oh, no, he worked with the big boys. I mean, this guy, what did the Audemars Piguet, the Royal Oak, the Patek, Nautilus,
The Bulgari.
Man, everything. The Omega, Constellation. Everything.
So why is the Constellation not on your one watch list?
Yeah. I don't know.
So which one is it? Which one from Gerald is it?
I just think the Nautilus.
All right. Cool. So I think we can close it with this. And thanks a lot, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you for making the time to do this. Really appreciate it. It was a really fun conversation. I think one of the most fun conversations I've had.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I told him that if the three of us sit together and do it, I knew it would be a fun conversation. So, thanks a lot for doing this.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Cool.